Hello, Bonsai friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonsai, and welcome to episode 102 or 102 of Little Things for Bonsai People. It is the year 2025, or at least when this recording will come out. It is the year 2025, and this time I am joined by one of my co-hosts, Carmen Leskovienski. How's it going, Carmen?
Pretty good. How are you?
Pretty well. It's actually getting a little colder here. We always talk about the weather, but before we start talking about the weather too much, let's introduce our third time special guest, Jonas Dupuy. How's it going, Jonas?
Great.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you so much for coming back and agreeing to put up with us a third time.
Anytime.
Yeah. Cool. But yeah, we're going to be talking to Jonas about Acer rubrum or red maple or swamp maple, whatever you guys might call it in y'all's range. We're going to talk about them for the purposes of bonsai, of course, and the pros and cons of using them and just in general, like how difficult they are and how easy they are, because I find them to be a fascinating species that people should be using more. But before we get into that, I do need to mention that our podcast is sponsored by our amazing patrons over at patreon.com/littlethingsforbonsaipeople. You can head on over there and become a best bud and hang out in the Discord and talk bonsai all day long with these people. So we have two new bonsai best buds, Shane Miles and Ethan Kauf. It's like cough with a K. So I'm assuming that's how you say that. And then we have our featured best bud. This week is going to be Radtron Studio. Thank you so much, Radtron Studio, supporting at the $5 level. And then we have our specimen best buds, Unryuin in Australia. Thank you, Jay. And then Bill's Bayou, Bill Butler. Thank you for supporting at the $30 level. And then, of course, we have our main show sponsors, Joshua Roth Tools and, of course, Underhill Bonsai. Thank me and thank John for sponsoring the show.
Thank you.
A little bit extra. And then, of course, we can't go much further without talking about our editor, Matt O'Donnell. I'll praise him because he makes us sound smart. He cleans up our audio, makes us enjoyable to listen to. Go over to mattodonnell.com and you can contact him about doing your own podcast show or becoming part of a, I guess, a greater podcast thing. I don't know. He's been trying to start his own little network of podcast shows. So if you guys want to work with Matt, he's an amazing editor. If you like the quality of our show, you can go work with him there, as well as if you have any audio engineering projects. He's a set bassist living in Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee, more like. He's an all-around awesome guy. I have to say it every time. It is in the script. So I'm not saying it because I have to be nice.
But it's also true. You know, I've been trying to wrangle some people into my crazy podcast idea that I was talking about on the 100th episode. And, you know, I'd be curious about that. Matt said, yeah, Matt said, go for it. But I got to get at least one other person on board. And
what? Why is it still a mystery?
Like, because I don't want anybody to take my idea. It's so stupid. I'll tell you later.
Oh, okay. It's odd to have mentioned it twice and we still don't know what it is.
I'm just disappointed that nobody's like, yeah, let's do it is the problem. Except for Matt. Matt's on board, but.
So you invited Matt, but not me. That's fine.
Well, it's not.
It must be something really special.
It's not. It's so dumb.
I mean, I've definitely got time for one more podcast show, you know.
Okay.
Whatever.
You know what? Do you want to do it with me?
We'll see. We'll see. Okay. It depends on what the topic is. It's a little off topic of what we're talking about right now, though.
It has nothing to do with bonsai.
Cool. And great that we could share this conversation.
Yes.
Anyway. So, yeah, we're going to talk about red maples today. And so the reason why we brought you on, Jonas, is because I know you've written quite a few articles about some Acer rubrums of your own. And we can go through those and kind of discuss them. But I was just wanting to kind of go over Acer rubrum because I feel like they're really underutilized. It is the most common like maple species in all of North America from what I've done some research and have seen. I can't think of anything else that kind of has a prominence in, you know, up and down the East Coast. And I'm pretty sure they grow over in y'all's area naturally as well, right?
It's all up and down the Eastern seaboard from Florida to Canada, but it doesn't go that far west.
Okay. But they will grow.
Oh, yeah. There. Yeah, they'll pretty much grow anywhere.
Yeah. They're really interesting species because not only will they grow just about anywhere, but we also have different variations based off of climate and zones too, but overall it's still just the same tree. I don't know if there's a huge difference between the Acer rubrum that you've experienced versus the one that grows here in Louisiana. We call it the Drummond's maple. It's the variant that we call it. I don't know if that has any distinct habits or features apart from the other ones that we've experienced in Bonsai. So I'll let you kind of kick us off, Jonas, with your kind of overall thought on Acer rubrum.
Like you mentioned, I think it's one of the most underutilized pieces of native material we could be growing in the U.S. I had seen them here and there over the years. Actually, the first one I saw was probably at Michael Hagedorn's garden, the Ann Spencer tree that was featured at the expo this past fall. And that's a fantastic tree that shows that they can be grown and kept small in a pot for a long number of years. And it's just one of our best examples that I know of in the country of a more refined red maple. I started working with him directly when I took over a bunch of trees from a friend's collection. And he had trees that included a kind of a forest planting of red maples that his father collected out of a swamp in Florida in the mid or early 80s, actually.
Oh, wow.
And so these are trees that had grown up, died back, grown up again, died back again. And I've been having a ton of fun playing with them for the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And it's just that one forest? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And I've taken it apart a couple times. I've done big cuts, little cuts, done a bunch of different things to it. And so it's been really fun to see how well it's responded over that time.
And what were you going to say, Carmen? I'm sorry.
What was I going to say? Oh, I guess I never thought of them as growing all the, as far south as Florida or Louisiana, even just with the, and that they can live, I guess they don't need as cold of a cold period as I imagined that they did. So that's interesting to me. I just imagined that they needed a really, really cold winter, but I guess they don't.
It's an interesting species. There's not a ton about them in the literature, but there's this great, maybe book length article almost on them that you can find online. And it talks about the distribution and it kind of spreads out, you know, down to a fairly narrow tip down south, but it just gets kind of wider and wider as it goes north, quite a ways up into Canada. What at least that one researcher found is that you could take the maples that are growing in cold climates and bring them south, but you can't take the maples starting in the south and take them up north. In other words, when they're used to the good life, they're going to have trouble adjusting to big winters, but they can go in the other direction.
Interesting.
All I know is that mine has gone from, I think it was originally around 82, 83. It went from Florida at one point to Texas and then to, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area. And it still has the basic characteristics I'd expect to see in those trees.
Cool.
So it's from cold to warm or warm to cold. I'm sorry.
It can go from cold to warm, but it can't go from warm to cold. So the trees that are in the south where it's warm must have some genetic variation where they cannot tolerate the cold. But the ones up north, it seems like they can tolerate the cold, but they don't necessarily need it as badly as some other species do.
Interesting. And I doubt anyone's actually studied that much of that. So I would take all of this as pretty deeply anecdotal.
Yeah, that's, it's kind of
I don't know who would be in the business of moving red maples north and south for the sake of studying all of this.
I mean, after this episode, there might be people hit me up, you know, because we've had a couple of like species spotlights that we've done on episodes and people ask me, does Underhill have any available? And I've sold stuff like, you know, I've sold trident maples and bald cypresses and a couple of other random things, obviously, that we sell here that just because I talked about them. But mentioning red maples, which this feels like a no-brainer to me, that people should experiment with, but there's been so many complaints about various things like leaf size and
well, let's
funguses.
Start there. If we were to do a good, bad, and ugly, what are the bad and ugly of the species that you've experienced so far?
From me personally, you know, and it's funny, we talked about just a moment ago how they don't like to go from hot to cold. I do have one that came from Colorado and it's had problems adjusting, but has the same characteristics. But that might also, that might be one of the cons, is they don't like that movement too much, but but it should be doing better because it's the other way around. It was the from cold to hot. But yeah, anyway, the pros to them that I've seen so far is obviously the growth rate is out of this world. You know, I've had seedlings in pots versus the ground, and obviously in the ground, the percentage of trunk size and height's going to be a little bit more. But it's not by a very large margin in my experience. This, for example, I do have a tree that I dropped in the chat that I'll talk about a little bit later on as far as developing their Nabari versus ones I've grown in the ground. And it should be obvious from the photos. And these photos are going to be on our Instagram page. If you go to Little Things. Yeah. I'm sorry. I almost got mixed up with Underhill. If you go to Little Things for Boneside People on Instagram, you'll see pictures of red maples that we're talking about on this episode. Post it there. And so pro is that they grow really fast. In the ground, they grow pretty good. Whereas one of the cons that comes up with that is that when they grow, they do run really long roots. So the surface roots will just go really far out. We'll get these big, gigantic roots. We'll have like a roughly 2 to 3 inch trunk. And then you'll have a surface root that is just looking for a water source that will shoot off in one direction. You'll get this really uneven looking Nabari. So that's a huge bummer if we can't track how they're growing in the ground very easy. In a pot, as long as they're up potted and their roots are dealt with, which is something that I've found that's really cool with them as far as a pro for them goes, is that if I'm growing a seedling and I'm just growing that little tree to, you know, the next size up pot to the next size up, I can actually cut a little bit of those roots, those running roots on the bottom with each succession of up pot during the growing season. They don't slow down if you cut their roots, from my experience here. They just keep going. And we're in a warmer, humid environment here. So I have one in the chat on Zoom for you guys that y'all can see that video of me spinning the tree around. That's a tree that I grew in one season. I got that Nabari from a seedling that was roughly about the size of a permanent marker. And then it just shot up and it got to like 7 feet tall. And I just kept up potting it and cutting the roots like they're supposed to, and up potting it and cutting the roots like they're supposed to. And I did it like 3 times and it just got a huge flare on the Nabari. And then it sat in that pot for a while. So that was all done pot grown. And then, of course, we talk more about their growth rate and stuff, but that also results in what I think is a little bit of a weaker trunk as far as what we can do as far as cutting them back. And like you said, Jonas, like the ones that you've worked with, they have died back. I don't know what kind of dieback you're experiencing, but I'm sure it'll be similar to mine. Whereas if you cut down a red maple, they have a hard time forming a Nabari, and their core, their heartwood is super soft because they're putting on rings of wood so quickly that it's not the most stable wood that I've ever seen on a deciduous tree like this, you know. And then of course,
so that provides some context for people. Is in the big picture, we can kind of categorize red maples as a very quickly growing deciduous species, and that brings along with it all of the goods and bads for that. The good being that it develops very quickly, it tends to be quite vigorous, and it tends to withstand some pretty aggressive work. The bad side of that is you end up with softer wood that rots a lot more, really long internodes, large leaves, and roots that can get out of control. Mm-hmm. And so that poses different challenges depending on the stage of the material that you're working on. As a grower, when you're asking for accelerated growth, that might be pretty tricky to do a quick grow and try to build up a good size one and then make that happen without leaving big scars that start rotting right away. I don't know how that would go. That'll be fun. But if the tree can grow slowly, or if you can at least start with a trunk and then start reducing from there, we can just apply the techniques we know to employ when it's time to slow down something that naturally wants to go really fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I know from the Ann Spencer maple that you and Carmen mentioned earlier, you know, and Carmen, you can kind of give us your insight on that one, because you worked with it a good bit on your apprenticeship too, mm-hmm. is that one was pretty scarless. It didn't have any obvious big rot points on it or cave-ins on the heartwood that would have caused any issues like we're talking about with the, you know, fast growing deciduous species. And so it makes me kind of think, will more people be turned away from red maples from just hearing that? Because a lot of people want to go with the Japanese aesthetic, and also the rule of thumb is that there should be scarless trunks on deciduous trees, especially in dormancy when we can appreciate the branching. We don't want something that would be considered a glaring flaw in the trunk line. But I'm seeing as trends are kind of going on with deciduous trees, and we have more practitioners in, you know, North America and of course across the world, but North America predominantly right now, we're having a little bit more interest in deciduous trees. People are starting to say that it's okay, that that's just the American native deciduous way, because we do have a lot of old twisted trees with holes in them here. So I don't know if you guys agree with that, that I'm calling it a trend, but I think it's just more people are accepting it more as time goes on.
Yeah, I think, I mean, with the Ann Spencer maple, the way she grew that tree was slow. Like, it was a seedling in a pot, and it was in a pot its entire life. So there wasn't that kind of push that you see with a field grown tree, or even like a like stock grown in a pot, where, you know, you have those really big extensions and quick growth. I mean, this was just year after year after year after year in a pot for however many years it was in like that pot.
50 years
is a long time. Yeah. So we didn't run into those kinds of issues that you're talking about, but I think once you can get an established trunk, you know, and start to slow down your growth rate, then you'll kind of move away from some of those problems. But I can see that being problematic as a grower, for sure.
Which may not be as much of an issue for the average hobbyist, unless they're trying to grow them from scratch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if they're pushing them really fast, really, you know, quickly. Fast and quickly mean the same thing, don't they? Yeah, then that could be a big problem.
I mean, foot on the gas as a grower versus someone who is growing them in a pot, you know, primarily, I think there's a, I don't know. Because growing it slow, like, when we say slow, I mean, how much growth are we asking out of the tree each year? You know, I think that's something I'm trying to dial back a little bit, because I'm used to in especially where I'm at, my growing range, like our trees just went dormant. I know that that you and Jonas have a little bit of a different take on this. Like you mentioned, Carmen, that it's like negative degrees.
Yeah, there's a couple inches of snow on the ground. Yeah. We've been dormant for like 2 months.
Yeah. And like the trees just lost their leaves this week in Louisiana. Like, it's late December. So, and I stripped a red maple
bananas
to like do a styling on it, I think last month, because I was just getting tired of waiting. I wanted to do a little bit of wiring and setting some stuff up, and then it budded again. I was like, well, there we go. Because it was 80 degrees last week. And so I can ask a lot more about out of my deciduous trees than you would, obviously. And then for Jonas, what is it? What is it like over where you're at? Because I know it's warmer as well.
It could be anything. I mean, today it's 56 degrees right now, but it could just as easily be 70 degrees right now. But it's not spending much time below 40.
So your red maple forest is doing just great then. Like, they're in their dormancy, I'm guessing.
So mine had turned about half dormant a couple weeks ago. And so just for lack of, for really no reason, I just defoliated the whole thing. What I start doing is giving trees winter break around this time of year. So from late December, early January, anything that hasn't lost its leaves that benefits from some dormancy, I'll just strip all the leaves off. And so some years everything falls away, some years it doesn't. We haven't had a strong cold snap. We might have touched the 30s once or twice is all. And so that doesn't really have much of an effect on how I grow it or deal with it. It's just more a matter of, you know, how big do I want the messy pile of leaves to be at the base of the tree before clean it up? That's kind of the only variable.
Yeah.
Now, when yours go dormant, how long do they stay dormant for, Evan?
I would say till mid-March, depending on what our winter does. So it's a pretty short window. You know, I could push them to grow longer, obviously, if I used a, you know, a greenhouse or a cold frame or something. But some years I'm super caught off guard. You know, it'll come sometime in February. I'll be hanging out, you know, doing some trimming, collecting trees from the wild and come back to the nursery. And the red maples are always the first ones. I don't know if you guys have experienced that too, but it's kind of funny because red maples are not just bonsai material to me. They're also something that has a little bit of a nostalgic kind of feel to me, is that in the South, they're the American South, they are the first trees to put out flowers. I don't know if they flower for you guys. I've seen them on, yeah. So probably Michigan, they probably do as well. As bonsai, I had never seen one flower before, but when you drive the interstate in Louisiana and you look over and you have these white grayish trunks and you got red little tiny, like the beginnings of the flower, like the seed pod, and then you have these white flowers, gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And that tells me when I see that, I'm like, oh crap, it's time to repot, because that's the red maples signal. If winter's over, the red maples are ready to go. They don't wait. So yeah, I would say roughly 2 months, 2.5 months of dormancy, true dormancy for some of our trees. And like you said, Jonas, I have to force most of my trees into dormancy. Like I've got bald cypresses with green leaves on them still. And I'm like, come on guys, we got work to do, you know? Another discussion that I've been having, so me and Guy, Guidry have talked a lot recently about deciduous in Louisiana, and he's kind of gotten onto this kick where he won't work on a deciduous tree, unless it drops its leaves for him. And so he'll wait till the absolute last leaf drop. You know, if he can go up and shake the tree and all the leaves start falling off on their own, obviously it's done. But I also heard Andrew Robson also say something very similar too. He's like, let them, you know, stop pruning and then go to that period whenever the leaves are ready to start just falling on their own. Then you can start doing winter work. So it's kind of a toss up. And when we're going to start working on our red maples, and when is the right time to do it? Because, you know, we're going to get into like internode length and leaf size and just here in just a moment, as far as a pro and a con as well. So what do y'all think about that?
So you kind of hit the basic tension for all deciduous trees, which is, in general, as the leaves are turning color, you get your opportunity to make your fall cuts. And Michael Hagner actually did a great job talking about that. You make your kind of your smaller edits in fall, and you make your bigger edits more toward the front of the growing season. And that's, I'd say, the basic recipe for everyone. The only reason it can be challenging is if you live in a place where you don't really have winter and you're wondering how to time things. And so then you look at what are the actual potential costs or reasons you might not want to do that. The only reason you might not want to cut a little bit earlier is because you're going to get a new shot of growth. And so the way I think about that is, the number one hedge against getting growth right before a cold spell is, like you say, waiting until as late as possible, which is why I'll often ask myself, when am I okay with the tree producing new growth? Because I know it'll be able to be healthy. And, you know, the tree will get a good return on investment for producing that new foliage. And so the most conservative thing to do would be to wait until right when the new foliage starts pushing or the new buds start opening. I'd say that'd be the latest time if you're being super duper conservative. And then you do your, then you could do fall or spring cuts at that point. And that might be in, if it's super warm, maybe January, more likely to be February or March for folks. I like it when the trees go to sleep a little bit and it's just cool enough that they can stay asleep for a couple months. And so that's why I tend to strip away the leaves at the end of the year. Chinese quince being the obvious example for me, they can put on new growth all winter long. Like what they think their definition of winter and my experience of winter are two very different things. And so I've got some plums that have fresh growth on them and some Chinese quince with fresh growth on them. And those will be the very last deciduous trees I work on, probably early January. I'll prune everything back. And if they start growing, fine. If they wait a while, fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Deciduous trees are weird.
Seasonality, I don't think is going to be much different with red maples in terms of how people experience or work on it than other species. And hearing you talk about, you know, the good and the bad points, I think one thing I like to do is to go through what all the potential negatives about a species might be and then provide tips for people about how to get around most of them or as many as possible. Because I think the red maple's a case of a tree that gets a bad rap when there are actually a number of ways to get around what we think of as kind of the negatives. And so I always try to couch, you know, just realistically, what is the kind of growth the tree is going to produce? And then what do we do as the bonsai practitioners to then work with that species to get the kind of growth that we would like to see on the tree?
Yeah. And that's
a great way to approach it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not trying to sit here and put down the red maples at the same time. I'm like, oh, I'm going to promote them. And then I'm like, wait, this and that. And, you know, I don't like the way that
Well, there's a reason it occurred to you to promote them at all, because the world's not doing it for you. And so the fact that you're even featuring or highlighting the species speaks right to it. Like, I think a lot of people have shied away from it solely because of the big leaves. And if you get over that, then the rank growth is going to be what scares people away. But I think we actually have really good techniques for getting around both of those issues.
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
Hey guys, it's Evan with Underhill Bonsai, and I just want to tell you guys about Say Bonsai. It's going to be happening from March 28th to the 30th, 2025. We're going to be everything Louisiana for a full weekend, so we're going to include a crawfish boil, homemade gumbo, and other food trucks and vendors that are very special, I guess you can say, the southern culture of Louisiana. And also, the show will include a bonsai show with its own special awards, including Best in Show, Best Shohin, Best Traditional Design, People's Choice Award, and also a tongue-in-cheek Best Bald Cypress Bonsai Award. Guest artists and visiting artists will include Julian Tsai, Sylvia Smith, Mike Lane, Carmen Lesko-Viansky, Dawn Ketting, Randy Bennett, and Guy Guidry. Each artist will be presenting demonstrations and giving workshops throughout the weekend. You can go over to underhillbonsaistore.com and go under our Say Bonsai Workshops tab, and you can sign up for just regular attendance. It's going to be $25 just to get into the exhibit tent, and then all the workshops will be spaced out, and they will all have individual pricing. We hope to see you guys there.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about leaf size. I mean, I know little leaf linen has become more popular as a deciduous tree, and the leaves on those are huge, you know.
Yeah, they're not that little.
Yeah, they're the littlest linen.
I guess so.
But yeah.
Another great species and an often overlooked species. If you find good material, I would love to add one of those to the collection. They're great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then another great species that's got a large leaf that people overlook is the Persian witch hazel.
I'm not familiar with that one.
They can grow here. I have to get let me see if I can look up the nomenclature, not the nomenclature, but you know what I mean, the Latin name for them. Mm-hmm. They're a weird tree. Let's see. It's the Paradia.
Okay.
Persica. Yep. I think is how you would say that. But yeah, they're
Parodia persica. Mm-hmm.
They're kind of like they're also common named called like an ironwood, because people are reminded of like the hornbeam, because they do have like a hornbeam kind of looking leaf. But the bark is way different. And it's actually another outstanding species. And I've got one here that we've been working on for a while, and the fall color on it is outstanding. It's like, it's got the orange, red on the inside, and then yellow on the edges. It's just got that perfect sun-kissed burst kind of look to it, where it's a gradual color change throughout the whole season, and then turns purple and then the leaves fall. And I'm like, oh, it's like almost everything that like the sweet gum can do.
I was gonna say it sounds like a sweet gum. Yeah.
Yep.
That's great.
Yep. Except it's a more of like a hornbeam looking leaf.
Hornbeam look.
Yep.
Cool.
Sorry. And the leaves on that are enormous as well. Mm-hmm. So I think people are getting a little bit more curious about the other species that are really good, like little leaf linen or the Persian ironwood, Persian witch hazel, other name for that one. Uh-huh. And I think the Acer rubrum, I've seen them. I've got some of them here at Underhill, where we've grown forest plantings and individual plants for bonsai stock. And the ones that let's give you examples of some of the ones that I have here. I've got a forest planting of bald cypress, of course, because I'm Evan and I have to talk about bald cypress constantly. And amongst them, so it's a really tall, lean forest of like 13 trees. And there's five Acer rubrum that I have grown from seed that I collected at someone's house. They were just, they call them gutter trees, you know, trees that were just kind of growing miscellaneous places. And so I just popped them up because they were easy to collect because they weren't even in the ground. They were growing in leaf litter and in cracks and crevices of like the sidewalk. And I have a handful of those trees, and I just put them straight into the forest planting. I didn't pot them. I should not use that word there. But they integrated beautifully with the bald cypresses, because there's also like this thing that I've noticed that the bald cypress and the Acer rubrum are good at being, you know, environmental woodside. What would you call that? Miss horticulture graduate over there, whenever two species kind of work together, it's like communication between species. Symbiotic, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Just something simple like that. Yeah, not going to go too crazy with plant physiology or anything like that when they operate together. But I found that Acer rubrum and bald cypress don't really compete with each other all that much when it comes to environmental factors for some reason. Like the Acer rubrum will pretty much stay understory to the bald cypress in our range here in Louisiana, which is interesting. So I've put them in a forest planting together. And of course, I'm having to prune really strong shoots that come off the Acer rubrum, but they have reduced down to the leaf size is like the size of a trident maple before you get that super nice small trident maple. Like it's the natural trident maple leaf size is what I would say. Mm-hmm. And it looks beautiful. And then the fall color on them, just last week, they were that crimson red with orange edges. That's gorgeous. And so that's kind of one way I've approached them with is forest plantings. And of course, like you said, Jonas, the forest planting that you have, that came from just a collection down in Florida. If you look at the National Arboretum, there's Von Banting's really well-known Acer rubrum forest planting that's been there for a long time. I mean, that forest planting has got to be 40 plus years in training from seedlings that were collected along the interstate is where he got those from. And those have scaled beautifully. And they're in a really shallow container. They've been in that pot for a long time. So they do have that capability of being slowed down like that, you know. But I think that's probably one of their strong suits is being in a forest planting as well. And it also kind of helps them as far as they don't get overcrowded very easy. But when they do kind of fuse, the roots start to kind of work together. I mean, I guess the energy gets more balanced across that, because it's true that once the roots start to fuse, then it almost acts like one plant if it's the same. Mm-hmm. In a way. Does that make sense? I don't know. That's yeah, the kind there's of like enough process.
There's like enough competition within the forest that starts to slow them down over time. Is that what you're
thinking? Little bit. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Jonas, you've been working with your forest planting for 5 years, and you said you've broken them apart, put them back together. So, you know, as far as forest plantings with them go, what do you kind of think? Is that, you think that's an advantage for them?
It's an advantage for us as bonsai practitioners, because I don't know of a large number of great red maple trunks that are out there.
Mm-hmm. It's challenging.
And so when you're starting with younger, more modest material, it's, I think, a really easy way to come up with a composition that takes advantage of the best features of Redwood Maples, which are you get fantastic trunks, just really bright white trunks. And then you have the contrast of the ruddy, the kind of reddish brown new growth out on the tips. And so you get a lot of great natural color variation for free. The downside of that is that they have to get really old before they start forming any craggier bark than that. You can expect that white bark to be there for a very long time. Mm-hmm. That can be decades before that starts changing.
And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. I know in bonsai, we're always striving for old. And I can appreciate a springy, youthful feeling forest planting, especially with the contrast of the red tips. That's a great thing to point out. Because I can't think of a lot of other trees that have that stark of a difference between, you know, obviously the more woody lignified pieces, and then you have your springier, you know, fresh tip growth. It's just like that nice red color. So it has a really good look to it.
I feel like the whiteness of the trunk kind of makes it look older, even if it doesn't have the bark that an aged tree might have, which I think is probably a really good benefit. Because even the Ann Spencer maple, I mean, it's not as barky as a lot of other trees, other deciduous trees that you might see. But it's getting there. But yeah, it's the red maples take a long time. But that contrast is super, super nice.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think of like the sugarberry or the hackberry, the Celtis lobigata that grows here. Mm-hmm. They have a really white bark as well. And then they don't have any kind of huge difference in the color tone. Like the red maple's got that obvious red. But whereas the hackberry that we have, the southern hackberry that I mentioned, that one is so twiggy. It kind of makes up for it. It's like that's that species. Kind of stake in the bonsai game is like, I can make super duper twigs, like really fine twigging. And that's, I think that's one of the things we need to kind of go into is how do on Acer rubrum, how do we reduce leaf size, manage it, and then get more twigs versus coarser growth on them is kind of going to be another one of the challenges that we have. But if we can get that, obviously it goes a long way. So,
yeah, and that's luckily one of the easiest things that all you can do with it. The other way you can contrast the red maple with other species when you're talking about trunk color is when you deal with a straight Acer palmatum, for instance, they start out green typically and they turn over a long period of time white. Red maples turn white very, very quickly. And so it takes very few years to get what looks like a mature trunk color very quickly. And you always get that contrasting color. So you've got two benefits right out of the gate. And in cases like the Spencer tree, as they age, say when you're 20, 40, 50, 60 years down the road, you may not get the same level of cragginess you see on some species, but in the way that hornbeam without scars will be primarily white with some browning on there. Some of the best maples primarily white with some of the kind of brown striations on there. The red maples kind of get, it's almost more of a textural change where you get these little kind of bumps in the trunk up first that make it look old. And that's kind of where the Spencer tree is, where it's less the striations that we'd expect, but it's just a different character of that bright color. So you got all those benefits just baked into the trunk right off the bat. And so then you get into the branches and the leaf size. And I'd say there's a lot of points to make about leaf size. The first being that in general, I don't really care anything about leaf size. It just doesn't matter for anything to me because I care about what trees look like in spring. But I know that some people care about leaf size. I am very picky, however, about internode length or branch density. How twiggy can you get the trees? Over time, as you create twiggy branches, the twiggier you get, you're going to get leaf size for free. So if you focus on techniques that produce lots of fine twigs, you're going to get leaf size for free. And red maples can, in a single season, go from a first flush of leaves that are 4 or 5 inches across down to leaves that are 1 inch by 1 inch or smaller by the end of the same season.
Tiny. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Jonas, because I feel the same way where leaf size doesn't necessarily matter to me because ideally we're showing trees without leaves. But I think so many of our shows happen over the summer when people have trees in full leaf that it becomes more of an issue than maybe it needs to be. But you absolutely that, you know, the smaller leaf or leaf size is directly related to twigginess. So the twiggier you get, then you get the leaf size thrown in for free. That was a, yeah.
So then the question is, exactly how do you get that twigginess? Well, you know, earlier, Evan, you'd mentioned about the foot on the gas, foot on the brakes. What's fun about a species like red maple is I don't even think about it that way. If it's not dead, it's going to be growing quickly in general. If it has some sunlight, some water, some fertilizer, even without the fertilizer, unless the tree is really, really weak and really, really starved for, you know, nutrients in the soil, it's just going to grow quickly. And the tree will naturally produce suckers, and it will produce these awful long shoots that get out of control really quickly if you're not on top of it. Mm-hmm. And so when that's actually one care note is when you see suckers or something growing out of shape, if you don't want it to thicken, reduce or remove it immediately, because the sooner you get to it, the sooner the tree can be incentivized essentially to produce growth on those branch tips.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest kind of setbacks is if you're growing red maple for bonsai and you have been working on a couple of branches and then you step away for a season, maybe you have a busier schedule than some of us, you know, that primarily work on bonsai for a living, which is understandable because this podcast should reach out to both, you know, beginners and experienced practitioners on that. And you step away for a moment and your red maple has done what you've said, Jonas, where it gets that suckering growth. And that happens on a lot of deciduous trees, like elms and definitely bald cypress and hackberries and so forth. They'll do that where I kind of tell people, if you are working on an older branch on a deciduous tree that is quite strong, that anytime you cut it back, you've made a mark on that branch where the tree is like, okay, that didn't work. I don't want to grow here anymore. So I'm going to give this another shot. And so that tree will count that branch as kind of like weak and broken and it's not worth its time and energy. So it'll try to do a sucker. And if that gets out of control, then yes, you'll probably lose that the potential to build that older branch back out. So yeah, removing them is a really great way to say that is like, you know, how many auxiliary buds are back on that collar of that branch waiting to burst? We can't rub them off because we want to keep them there in case that branch goes to crap and we need to do a reset. So we kind of have to do this constant balance of keep them in check, you know, keep as many buds intact as possible. And that was another thing I wanted to kind of bring up as I got further into this, talking about, you know, reducing leaf size and bud selection, is that from my experience, if you have a red maple branch developing, you're trying to get that mature look to it and you've combated the suckers, now you have to worry about the tips and your latent buds for a little bit further back. You cannot damage those bud sites. I've damaged bud sites and on a red maple branch and been like, it's over. I got to cut 3 inches off of this branch because it's very difficult to get them to bud back like that if they don't have that that inner node ready to go. And if you have a damaged section, because there's only so many bud locations that I've found on red maple, on old red maple branches that you can bud back and get inner growth on. And then vice versa, like some trees will, if you do a cut site, then it'll just grow a bud right at that cut site. Like elms will do that, but red maples, not so much. They'll just die back right next to the next inner node.
So the pro tip for red maples is, it really applies to pruning maples in general, which is when you're pruning shoots, follow your basic principles of directional pruning. And whenever possible, prune to visible buds. And that's a huge one. And so find a bud that looks good at the internode length you're looking for and cut there. And if it doesn't give you the direction you want, then maybe that's where a little bit of wire could come in handy. But I'd say if you have small internodes, the directional pruning is huge. Otherwise, cutting to visible buds is big because they do have larger buds and they can get damaged and you lose that whole internode. Often the buds kind of disappear further back on a branch. And if you're cutting into old wood, then it's your basic deciduous roulette where you're going to get buds almost 100%. You just don't know where they're going to be. And so it's totally fine to cut into old wood. You just have to be comfortable with the the aleatory nature of the budding process, and you're essentially leaving it to chance, and the tree will let you know what's going to happen when you roll the dice.
Yeah, I've experienced that. You cut something thick back and have a stub, and then, you know, if you get 10 things growing out of that stub, and maybe one of them's going the right direction. It's like, it's crazy.
And branch angle and intersections, I'd say, would be probably one of the next pro tips, where I've seen more awkward angle branches growing at awkward angles on red maple. One of my frustrations with established red maple bonsai is you can often tell how the tree was grown, because you often see these big, long, straight sections, which mean that growth just went unchecked and it wasn't removed at the end of that season or the next n number of seasons. Mm-hmm. And likewise, you can see a bunch of, like on my tree, the whether by on purpose or by default, a bunch of kind of, you know, cowboy leg slingshot style branch intersections formed. That's what these naturally do, because as a lateral bud comes outward, it'll naturally curve upward. And so it's really common for an opposite pattern budding tree like a maple to produce these awful, awful patterns. Mm-hmm. We know this going into it. It's a maple and it grows fast. So it's really on us to be vigilant, identify those issues as they come up, cut one of the two, cut them at different sizes, wire them when they're young. Any of those easy fixes are fine. The only thing we can't do is sit back, watch it get awful, and then, you know, whine about it when it looks awful at the end of the year. And that's a big distinction between your backyard grower working on a specimen with a nice trunk versus someone trying to grow a tree from scratch, where you're going to have all of those challenges to look out for, which is not super straightforward if you're getting started with them.
Yeah. So I'm curious, based on the climate that both of you are in, how many times do you prune during the growing season and or do any kind of leaf reduction? Because really my only experience with these is, you know, maintaining the Ann Spencer maple. I haven't done much growing of the of this species in particular. And it sounds like since they're such fast growers, it's possible that you do, you have more than a single flush every year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
where my more like grew, a trident or more like a Japanese maple?
Yeah, you go first, Jonas, because well, my experience is like a little different.
Much more like a trident. So the friend I got the tree from, he used to fully defoliate it three to four times a year.
Wow.
And like no hesitation. And that's like literally run your finger along the branches, strip it clean 3-4 times a year. What I've found is that while the tree can definitely handle that, his goal in the defoliation was to bring the leaf size down. You're essentially bleeding off that energy again and again and again. My goals are a little different, so I kind of don't mind what it looks like as much. So what I'll do is any number of partial defoliations during the course of the growing season. So I remove big leaves when they develop. I cut shoots when they're getting out of silhouette, and it's a more kind of fluid process during the growing season. You can let go of that a little bit and just do maybe 2 or 3 passes during the year, or just kind of keep after it as you get to it. But they're pretty darn forgiving. The funny thing is what happens is if you're not fully defoliating, you're going to have the same problem you do, again, with all deciduous. The leaves are all different ages by the end of the growing season, and that's going to have a massive effect on what you get for fall color. Because apart from whatever we say is good or bad about the species, possibly the single best thing about the species is nearly guaranteed amazing fall color. And that counts a lot for me, because in general, we don't get fall color on any deciduous species, period. Japanese maples turn brown, crumple up, and fall off. It's awful. 1 in 10
That's
years.
That's so sad.
The reason that the world grows and loves these species are lost on us. And we still love maples because they're pretty in spring. But seriously, we generally don't get fall color on much at all. Red maples guaranteed beautiful. And it's orange, yellow, and red. It's just such a great mix of bright pink sometimes. I love it. It's fantastic. And so it's easily the prettiest tree in the garden every fall at my place.
Yeah, that's true for the Japanese, the Acer palmatums here, as well as, we get some decent fall color depending on, you know, how rough our summertime was here.
And then, if the leaves are not crispy and crappy looking, then our Acer pronatums will give us a pretty decent show. But yeah, the Acer rubrum is always best in show fall color here alongside our sweet gums. And also in complementary to the elm varieties, like the winged elm, cedar elms. Cedar elms are something else too. They've got a great fall color on them that contrasts really well in our landscape here. And for my bonsai, I'm just now starting to get to a point where, and I put them in the chat for the Zoom, and like I said, they'll be on the Instagram, where I've got these two trees, and this is one of the things that I was going to mention to you is about as far as pruning, because Carmen, you were like, how often do you guys prune? The way that I've gone about Acer rubrum recently is I was inspired by a post that author Jura made a while back, and he's the curator over at North Carolina Arboretum. I have to shout him out because he's got a great collection over there. He's got quite a few Acer rubrums with big trunks, small trunks, interesting trunk shapes that he's gotten out of these trees. And one of the things that he did was he got somebody actually brought him a chunk out of someone's gutter. Someone was cleaning their gutter out at their house and they pulled up this big giant leaf mulch and there was like over 100 Acer rubrums growing in this guy's gutter system. And so he took those trees and planted them all and did various different techniques with them, putting them, some of them in cord pots, putting some of them straight into the ground, you know, various different things. And so he called it like his 100 Acer rubrum challenge, basically. I took that seriously and bought 100 Acer rubrum seedlings and ran my own thing here, because I'm in a grow nursery, so I have the acreage to do it. So yeah, I planted a row of Acer rubrums and got a lot of different I got mixed results across the board. So the first year I put them in, they all grew like weeds, like they just took off. And so I wanted to see if I let some of them just go crazy. If I needed to do a ground chop to kind of encourage them to not grow so straight, if I wanted to chop and see if I can get a directional change and then try to heal the wound. Some of them did that. Some of the others, like we discussed a little earlier in this recording, that, you know, with a tree that grows so fast and then you cut it down, the wood's not stable enough. And then there's just not enough energy in the trunk there from putting all its effort in springtime, that I did lose quite a few of them. So my percentages started dropping off pretty dramatically. So I let them grow freely for the first year. In the fall and going into the spring, I did make my chops, and then I lost 20 of them. So yeah, I'm like 20% of them died. And I was like, okay, well, I had 100, I've got 80. Who needs 80 bonsai trees, you know, of Acer rubrums? Because this was solely like a project that I was kind of running, and I don't know if anyone's going to want to buy them. I guess they'll have to, we'll see how that goes. But and so the third year in, after those recovered, I did start getting some interesting things where I got some trees that were clumping up. Like I mentioned earlier, some of the roots got really disappointing where they just started running all different directions. And I got a few of them that made unfortunate, really unbalanced Nabari. So I tried to do something that I did with Trident maple, because we're growing Trident maple in that same area in that grow field. They're a couple rows back. And what I do with Trident maples whenever they grow really long roots like that is I'll go with a chainsaw or sawzall and I'll cut the root in the ground, kind of trench it around the tree and just force it, be like, you're going to grow fibrous roots back here, is what I do with those. And so, and that practice is kind of like something that I got from another nursery trade guy that was producing bonsai material in the ground like this. So cut one side one season, and if it has horrible roots on the other side, we'll cut the other side the next season, the next growing season. So that should kind of get them to grow back inwards, right? Well, the Acer rubrums both disliked that and kind of did what I wanted them to. Instead of growing back root to where I wanted them to, they would do these big giant ugly callusing on their roots and stuff that just wasn't suitable for bonsai. So I lost another 10 or so of them from that process. So it's been interesting kind of going through and seeing what, you know, how resilient they are. But if you look at Acer Drura's trees as well, a lot of his trees feature hollows and scars and stuff on them. And like I mentioned earlier, is hollows and scars acceptable at this point?
And the one tree, my favorite tree in his collection, would be Heartful Hollow. That's the one that I posted in the Zoom chat. You guys can see it's the last image I shared. So that one's pretty large. It's, I think it's got like a 12, 16 inch Nabari on it, but it's got that giant hollow in the middle of it. Just because it's a cerebrum, it was cut, it had some dieback stuff, and he grew a new top. So, you know, it's inspiring to see that tree, but the Ann Spencer journey is going to take way longer than the Heart of Hollow journey, obviously, because like we mentioned earlier, Jonas mentioned earlier, when you make those cuts, you're going to cause dieback and issues like that. If you're not taking, you know, if you're not growing and taking your time with it, which I don't know, I have a couple of trees I'm also taking my time and slowing them down as well. But I did pull two of those Ace Cerebrums from that field. So 2 out of 100 trees so far have given me something that I'm halfway happy with. So that tells you the statistics on it. So it's kind of silly. So I don't know what.
You probably double that with your next batch of 100.
There you go. Exactly. that's my thought is, do I go another 100 and then scrap the rest of it? Because a few of them back there are not bad that I'm kind of going back in. I found one in the back that I hadn't looked at in a while that had a pretty good trunk on it, but it's going to result in that Heartful Hollow look. It's going to have a big hollow spot in the trunk, which I'm okay with. You know, some people might not be okay with that.
I would say do 20 of them instead and grow them in big pots instead of in the ground, so you have more control over your roots.
Yep,
and
that's the next
stage. That way they won't get out of control, but it'll be more work up front.
Yep. That's right. The very simple fix for the roots getting out of control is you just cut the big roots as soon as possible. And that's going to be a lot easier to do when they're out of the ground than when they're in the ground. In the ground, it'll be tough because they will bud and callus just like you described, and they'll grow near the cut site rather than where you want the new roots to be, right near the trunk, which is why probably spending 2, 3, 4 years developing the root base you want before you put it in the ground could also solve a lot of those problems, because then at least the core of what you're trying to develop will be in good shape, almost guaranteed good shape, before you get that really accelerated growth. And whether you do that in the ground or in the pot, I always recommend get those roots you want, and it'll be way easier than redoing it later. Of course, you might try layering them. I haven't tried layering rubrum. I don't know if that's going to be an easy one or not. Maples in general layer fairly well. Just no idea about whether or not these work.
You could try that with some that don't have a very good Nabari. Yeah, some of your rejects. Try to air layer them off the ground. Yeah, layer them off the stock in the ground.
Have to call out one of the people that are in the Baton Rouge Club, and we talk about him a lot. Joel Jenkins has a cerebrum that he air layered, and it is possible. I haven't checked with him on that tree in a while. I'm sure he's going to hear this episode, so send me a picture of that, Joel, of what it looks like now, because he took an air layer. I want to say it was a big branch. I think he took an air layer off of it was like 3.5 to 4 inches. It was huge. And it took. So nice. I was like, okay. So it's possible, but
this sounds like a project for Joel then.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's kind of just like I like to pick up the misfit species and be like, all right, I'm gonna run all these trials on them. It's time to have some fun with this, because I'm a bonsai fanatic / nurseryman / I've just have so much time now to work on these all the resources.
With the new baby and everything.
Oh, yeah, that too. The baby is definitely giving me so much more time to manage these things.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm thinking about the air layer versus the make the roots you want in the pot situation and then grow them to the size you want, because that's one of the things I was going to say is that video that I sent to the Discord, to the Zoom chat, where it's rotating around, that tree was where I was kind of doing the root building process, and I got a pretty decent Nabari in like I said, in that year's time frame. So like y'all said, it might just be best to go in with 20 or so, do that, cut those roots, get them right, because that is one of the biggest struggles with deciduous, is that we go out and we get excited, we go into the woods, into the wild, and we do quote unquote Yamadori hunting. We're not in the mountains, but you know, I've always kind of challenged that. It's like, we're just
pulling trees from the wild at this point. And we get ahead of ourselves and we cut the roots all weird and funky, and then they grow back weird, and we got running roots coming off. We got tubular looking roots coming off in weird sections because the tree is just trying its best to catch back up and rebuild. And so we get some really gangly, weird looking root systems on these collected trees. And so one of the things I'm kind of looking at too is those two trees that I did pull out of the field, they did collect really well. They collected easy. They took decently to the, you're cutting the roots back and putting them into a smaller, when I didn't go straight into a bonsai pot like that one where it's like, it's less than an inch deep and, you know, beautiful. No, it's in a mica pot that's like 6 inches deep with a nice amount of root in there. And it did, they did pretty well. If you're not rushing them, they took to it pretty well and they grew a lot of good shoots on them. So it is possible to collect them pretty easily once we put them in the ground. So that's a good thing to know, is that like if you build your roots good, in that first couple, you know, maybe a year or two, and then you put them in the ground and you put your, you know, we were saying earlier, put the foot on the gas and just get it to go crazy, then you should be able to get those trees back out of the ground with ease.
And on that note, that brings up some kind of tips for repotting these is I have found with, even though it's a very small sample set, I have done aggressive work that I would never recommend on friends or enemies on these. And the tree just didn't seem to care. Because I remember I thought, oh, I need to cram these in the pot. And the only way they'd look good is if I just cut it anyway. And so I separated this awful starting point, cut them down to just nubs. And that's where you get your benefits, those fast growing species. And that's one thing that helps them. They are able to put out a whole lot of roots after repotting. So I've found that they make really nice, fine, fibrous roots once they're established as bonsai. And I'm sure it'd be the same thing on the Spencer tree. Whatever the kind of core nabari or surface rootage is, you can work with that and it'll actually slowly get better, slowly, but better and better over time. And it'll form a very solid root ball of very fine roots and is a very nice thing to work with. Somewhat connected to that is I'd mentioned the reason that I mentioned the dieback is that the trees long before I got to them, the original forest had died back to the ground, shot up again from suckers. Some of those died, and then some of those shot up again from the ground. So interestingly, if they are mistreated or don't receive the care and or weather they want, they have the ability to bud either very low on the trunk or even from the ground. And so pretty much every single tree in the composition I'm working with is it's like in a redwood forest. It's the young shoots that have kind of emerged from around what was originally the main trunk. Some of those have rotten out to nothing but little holes. Some of them I've still preserved some of the remaining deadwood. And it's more of a grow, die, rebirth process story in those guys. But what's cool is I need to still do more adjustments in mine. You know, the tree on the right, I need to do some more rotation and move it a little bit closer in. And I am not going to hesitate to do that the next time I repot. Of course, we'll see if it works as well next time. But it's been very satisfying to work with the roots on red maple.
That's really cool that it was able to die all the way back and then regrow. I love that. And yeah, we were talking about the Ann Spencer maple. And, you know, it's an old tree and it always sends out some long shoots every year. But even so, as far as, you know, its main push for the year was more reserved than a lot of the other maples in the garden. But the roots never seemed to slow down, which was kind of fun. Right. I think we repotted it 2 years in a row, which feels like that was kind of nuts. And then I was shocked that it needed to be repotted again that soon. But then, as you were saying, Jonas, the Nabari does continue to develop over time. And before the expo this year, we spent a lot of time in the spring just kind of, I think Michael did a blog post about this, just kind of uncovering more of the Nabari that had just kind of been hidden under this mat of fine roots. And because it had been, you know, kind of hidden under there, it didn't have the same silvering as the rest of the tree. So we had to, you know, add a little lime sulfur to that and lighten up the color a bit. But Yeah, but there was so much under there that we just hadn't seen because the fine roots had really kind of taken over the pot again. So yeah, they're very, very strongly rooted trees.
Pro tip there that Carmen just mentioned is if you have a white trunk tree and you really like that and you're going to show it, like you said, you just uncovered all that stuff. Lime sulfur, mm-hmm. I heard that they lime sulfur like beech and hornbeam and stuff to get them to have the correct contrast to their trunks, to their branches and stuff. That's actually a pretty good thing. I lime sulfur hackberries here pretty often to get them because I just like them being white because, like I said, of old hackberries and landscape are white here with lots of hollows and weird, crazy, craggy trunks. So, and speaking of that, you know, I keep alluding back to like the old hollows and the dieback. And Jonas, you said you have the constant guy, the dieback kind of thing it's giving you this interesting sinuous root or tortoise back kind of look to it, these suckers coming out, and it keeps building, you know, and you get these really nice, interesting roots with holes in them and stuff. Just thinking about if we're reflecting nature with Acer rubrum, I've seen one Acer rubrum that absolutely blew me away that had to be over 100. I can't, you know, it's really hard to say because, I mean, we've got live oak trees here that are, you know, in that age range to older, and it's hard to determine. But you can tell by the way that the trunk looks, like we mentioned earlier, it goes from that white to that kind of tighter bark. It has a little bit more of a textural change. And I did see one. It was an old property over in Sunset, Louisiana, which is on your way to Lake Charles. And it's an old country back road area that one of my clients, I was going to go work on some trees with a client of mine, and they purchased this plot of land next to their house because they just wanted more open area. So they cleared it of all the invasive species and left all the American hardwoods. And one of them was this grandiose, just gigantic red maple. I've never seen one this big. It was like, wow. And it was, I mean, it had to easily be over 100 feet at the tip of its, you know, twiggy branches at the top. And I was like, this thing's got a lot of stories to tell. And it had branches that were, I mean, you wrap your arms around them and barely touch the other side that came out the top, but they had hollow strips and where it looked like the tree almost cracked in half at one point, and then it made like that shell kind of deciduous look that you see. And that was every main trunk. It had like three main trunks off of it, and they were all hollow like that. It was beautiful. And you could see the sunlight through some of the holes in the tree. And then, but one of the unfortunate things with the way that they grow naturally is that they have like this thing where it's just like fingery growth straight up in the air. So it wasn't very, it wasn't a very charming silhouette, but the trunk itself was very inspiring, I guess you can say, because we wouldn't allow some people get that hyper naturalistic look in bonsai and they want that kind of fingery, straight up deciduous growth habit. But I, you know, I still like them to be kind of more of mature padded branches. And, you know, that's going to be preference from to each his own. But yeah, I think there's so much to do to play around with that style and that look too. But I think I'm getting a little too far away from, I'm getting back towards the, you know, I'm just kind of excited about getting older. Acer rubrum's developed now. I'm like, wow, the possibilities. But yeah, long term, great species. Obviously. And as we kind of get towards the end of our conversation here about them, I wanted to kind of go over a care guide with them. I think that would be appropriate because in the past we've done, you know, we were joking about the episodes that got the most hits, most listens. It was like three trees that are great for beginners. Here's a couple more trees that are great for beginners and their care guides and stuff. And so it'd only be appropriate to give Acer rubrum their proper care guide. So go through that real quick. So well, what do y'all
from you two? How much sun do you give them?
From me?
Both of you.
So for me, it's full blasting sun. And during the summertime, just a slight 10% shade cloth just to get the heat off of them. But if they're in the shade, they're weak. So I'm doing full sun all year.
What about you, Carmen?
It was under, I think, the 50% shade at Michael's, but I mean, this was, again, I don't have a lot of experience growing these from scratch. This was just the Ann Spencer that I was familiar with, but we generally kept it under the 50% shade, sometimes under the 40% shade, but towards the earlier, the beginning of the year, but that was in like mid, when it was really hot in the summertime. But towards the beginning of the year, we kept it more towards the edge of the bench where it would get a little bit more sun. And then again, kind of towards the end of summer, before we started getting fall color, we'd sometimes move it back into a little bit more sun just to increase the intensity of the fall color. But it was usually 40 or 50% shade.
Yeah. So I think the experience the two of you just shared goes a long way to explaining that this is one of those deciduous species for which it's not that there's an answer of how much light or shade to give them. The way it's in a category of trees where I think if the tree can take it, you give it as much sun as it can take. And as it shows signs that that's not the most productive approach, you give it a little more shelter. For instance, young trees, trees growing quickly, trees where you're thickening anything, trees that are in the ground, trees in really deep containers, those are going to take a lot more sun than old trees, trees in late stages of refinement, trees with lots of twiggy branches. And so if that's
trees that are going to the expo,
for instance, but there's a couple things that are related to that. And so, you know, some trees like Japanese maple, you're going to want to give it the right amount of light as well, but it's more like more shade or less shade. Too much shade, you're going to lose a lot of the new growth, the leaves get too big. And that's very true. Red maples are extremely sensitive to light. If you give them more shade, the leaves are going to get giant really fast. The inner nodes are going to get longer. And the leaves actually turn a much darker color, whereas they look far paler green, almost anemic looking when you give them lots of sunshine, depending on how they're fertilized, the soil, all that. And so I think it's a great kind of canary for the coal mine in our gardens to find out how much sun is the right amount of sun for my specimen at my stage of development.
Yes. And I think that's a good general rule is overall for old deciduous to young, like so young to older deciduous trees. That's, you know, I think that, you know, that is, I've definitely witnessed that, like the more sun they get here, like that, that forest planting I mentioned earlier where they were intermingled with the bald cypresses, they get full sun with those bald cypresses all year long and have given me nice small leaves. They will throw that occasional suckering branch to where they're like, I'm going to grow right now. And it tries to shoot up pretty high there. But if I'm maintaining those, even though they're getting a lot of sun, I'm getting a lot of my interior growth to stick around. Cause I do, like you mentioned earlier, I do defoliate them. Not to the extent, I don't go hard on the point where I'm defoliating completely. I'm only taking out the absolutely like the biggest leaves, and I'm only leaving behind the leaves that the leaf size that I want. And then what will replace that will generally be around that size. There's still going to be a little bit of different in the leaf size, a little differentiation. But for the most part, they do pretty well in the full sun here. I do agree that some of the trees that I'm starting to slow down, I'm trying to, make those adjustments that I can put them in the shade more. But like the two trees that I have in the chat there, there's one that's a little shorter, a little bit more sudden movement. Then there's a couple of segments where there's a little bit more quicker, straighter movement in it. Those trees are still only 4 or 5 years old. So they're not mature yet. They're giving me mature growth that you would expect out of an older tree, just because of the way I've been fertilizing them and treating them, I think is just kind of encouraged them to just take things a little bit slower recently. That's something I need to think about. So for our care guide for placement and sun, full sun to partial shade, depending on development. I know that's kind of hard for people to gauge on.
It's the actual answer of everything in bonsai, which is it depends. I'm excited to go back to that answer.
I hate it when
the way
you say
I
that.
Phrase that is rather than tell people the phrase they don't want to hear is whenever the answer to the question is it depends, your question wasn't specific enough.
Yep.
There you go.
There you go.
And so you just force people to ask better questions, and then the answer will no longer be, it depends. And so we always have a way to get more out of people, force them to think a little more deeply about the question, and then we can be happy to give them a specific answer.
Yeah, I give Carmen a hard time about that response a lot.
I think that's a great description for the light care. Water, they tend to like a lot of water, too much water. Actually, have either of you had experience with too much water? Ever been in trouble?
No, not really. They're, I mean, we call them swamp maples here, and I think that the water is not, you know, wet feet's never really a big issue to them as long as they're in well-draining soil.
That's, I think, the key is that well-draining soil. It's one of the most thirsty plants in my garden, and if you give it the water, it will absorb, it will grow even faster, so. Mm-hmm. And no more than a moderate amount of fertilizer. I haven't noticed it needing a ton of fertilizer. Like we all talked about, they grow pretty darn quickly, but I wouldn't say more than a moderate amount of fertilizer in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I've not witnessed it needing, oh no, you're fine. I've not witnessed it, any of the maples really needing a whole, well, the tridents maybe need a little bit more, but yeah, in general, it seems moderate is good.
And I've been doing a really good balance of like the organic fertilizers that I've been giving my red maples that I'm trying to kind of build out a little bit more and get less of the aggressive growth. They take to it as long as there's the NPK is high in that organic. Mm-hmm. It's easier on them. Obviously, we're not going to burn them or make them go crazy. So they respond to organic high NPK fertilizers really well. They like that a lot. And I always just consider also local factors. So red maples commonly grow in areas where there's lots of leaf mulch from other trees. So it just makes sense that they consume that on a pretty regular basis. Lower pH, not super crazy low, but like I know that Acer rubrum, I should kind of dial that back. I know that Acer palmatum and Acer bagrarium, I hope I said that right. So the Japanese and the trident maple respectively, like a balanced pH, whereas the red maple, it's not super worried about pH. So there's another pointer there for water quality. They're kind of like one of those trees that don't mind growing in, just going to say it, they don't mind growing in shit, like crap, you know, like, so poor drainage areas they normally grow in and weird water qualities, they just kind of put up with it, you know.
But they'll grow a lot faster when they get into modern bonsai soil.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I found the tree in muck and putting it in fresh soil, bare rooting it, putting it in fresh soil made a fantastic difference.
Yeah. That's what I tell people is there's a couple of species here that people will treat, namely deciduous species here like elms and bald cypresses. They'll put them in just the most atrocious soil mixes. And I'm like, okay, well, if you babied this and give it some TLC, that will go way further than you could imagine because they're strong and it's resilient. It's putting up with what you put it in. But if you put it in high quality soil with good drainage and good particle size adjusted to what the tree needs, but the benefits, like all these energy balance and leaf size and growing habits and stuff, is so much easier to manage. So yeah, I would say, you know, we're going from fertilizer to soil, good, hydrated soil. I haven't put any of my red maples into Akadama mixed soils yet, but I imagine they wouldn't mind it. I know that Ann Spencer was in Akadama based soil as well. See, Akadama pumice and lava, correct?
Nope, just Akadama pumice.
Oh, cool. Even better. Mm-hmm. And Jonas, are you using Akadama pumice or what's your red maple mix?
I've put it in most of the standard mixes and it's fine as long as it's a modern mix with, you know, around half Akadama, give or take, you know, depending on your weather and your goals for the tree.
Yeah. So they take really well to what we would consider as boon mix or professional mix in the United States.
And what you said about the organics is funny. There's a small number of trees where if you use an organic that sits on the surface of the soil, something like Biogold, for instance, red maple is one of the species where the roots will immediately grow up into the fertilizer. And when you take the fertilizer cover off, it'll be part of the solid root block. Like there'll be no distinction between root ball and where the fertilizer was. You'll literally have a flat root ball with little lumps where the fertilizer cages were. Like they grow right into it and they grow solid in just a matter of months.
That should tell you something. If they jump up into those organic cakes, they might just like organic fertilizer.
Or that kind of root environment. So that's part of it, is the roots want to be where it's warmer and where there's available moisture and available nutrition. And then they are very happy.
Good point. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's one of the things I really encourage a lot of people with deciduous trees too, is doing a good cap or a top layer of like the sphagnum moss and local mosses, and then your organics settle into that. That's a beautiful environment for them. They like that. The ones that I've been growing slower, I've had great results. There's fibrous roots all over the place. And that's really cool to kind of hear it in that way from how you said it, Jonas, is like they want that warmer environment. So you have to be a little bit less worried about the shallower root system, as long as there's a good top layer to that soil that facilitates that environment they enjoy.
Yeah. In terms of other basics, repot them at the same old time of year.
Yeah.
Or deciduous, which is essentially right at bud break in spring. In terms of pruning, you know, you do your light pruning. Actually, you can prune it all during the growing season. Your final pruning would be around leaf drop, and you can do your bigger cuts earlier in the season, smaller cuts later in the season.
Yep.
And a lot of just basic deciduous. But we do have one other pro tip we can offer, because you mentioned something. To be fair, a lot of people have shows, or a lot of clubs have events all during the growing season. And so there are some good tips we can offer in terms of how you can get consistent leaf size that's a little bit smaller. And what's great about this tip is that it's pretty much just homework. As you work on red maple, if you practice defoliating, whether partially or fully, pay attention to what the leaf size is over the following or the subsequent weeks, so that you can find out exactly what makes sense in terms of, if my show's going to be August 3rd, maybe it's like a 5-week window, maybe it's only a 2-week window that I have to prune. In other words, how many weeks before my show am I going to prune to get those leaves right where I want them? Even if they end up getting bigger, you at least know when you're going to be doing that work. And so you can practice with a full defoliation if you all want them the same size, or a partial, depending on whatever's appropriate for the tree. But you can teach yourself how to create the leaf size you want with just simply starting and measuring, and then test it out.
Yep.
That's a great tip.
Another pro tip too, we were talking about repotting before we get to pests and diseases, which is always the most, you know, intimidating one to kind of deal with, was the repotting thing. We were talking about hard pruning practices on the roots, which they obviously take well to that. And I found too, I've got a couple of small Acer rubrum that I had grown from seedling, and I've had them for, they were misfits that didn't make the forest planting with the bald cypresses. So they're about 7-8 years old now. And I put one of them into a Shohin pot, and the roots got really, really dense, and then it started suffering. So obviously they do need to be cut back often. So when we do those aggressive cutbacks, a pro tip that I got actually when I was repotting the Ann Spencer tree with Carmen was peroxide, watering peroxide into the root system to help sanitize those big cuts we make on the root system. That can go a long way. That's actually those little things. Get it? The show's called Little Things. But those little things go a long way for our tree's health and development. Because we're dealing with trees that are, they didn't ask for us to take them out of the pot and cut them like that. So giving them a little bit of extra care with the peroxide watering is really beneficial. And then for pests and diseases, I know one of the biggest complaints in disease wise is leaf blight, or like the spotting on leaves on Acer rubrum. I've talked to a couple other people that have been doing bonsai for a while in Louisiana, and I'm always like, where's your Acer rubrums at? And they're like, they're like, if it's not the big leaf, it's the leaf spot. And they can't deal with that. That's a simple fungicide treatment, or overhead watering, or, you know, just making sure that you're hitting all of your preventatives at the right time of the year. I think that's one of the things that people get caught up on with Acer rubrum. Other than that, just basic needs there. I'm not going to say they're pest free, but not a lot of things bug them, pun intended. Leaf cutters will eat them. Just use a systemic insecticide to kind of reduce that and just remove damaged leaves. other than that, I don't really have any major issues with my cherubims with diseases. What do you guys got on that?
Oddly low maintenance. Like I don't see a lot of disease signs or pest signs. Like I've had aphids on young foliage, but as but that's everything. As the foliage hardens off, it usually takes care of itself. But in general, they're kind of a remarkably trouble-free species. I feel like I should knock on wood somewhere, but they've been pretty great. Like I see them around in street trees sometimes. I see them in nurseries and same thing. They tend to be pretty darn good. The biggest, the only time I see them less than healthy is when they've been lingering in awful soil for many years with little water and fertilizer. That's by far the most common problem I've seen with them.
Yeah, same here. Aphids. Otherwise, we don't have too, well, I haven't had too big of a problem with leaf spot in, I mean, mostly thinking of even landscape red maples. But a lot of that too is just, you know, one of the things you deal with maples, and I might just be a little bit more lax on, you know, unless a tree is going into a show, a little bit of leaf spot doesn't bother me too much. But, that also may be different where you are because your humidity is different. It might just be more prevalent there. But yeah, I think, you know, the biggest issue is when you see them in the Target parking lot and they haven't been watered or, you know, and they've been growing in a parking lot for 10 years. They're just very unhappy.
I would say that.
Yeah, that's more of a, you know, just general care issue than a disease issue. So,
yeah, don't take your inspiration to work with red maples from the parking lot.
Yeah. But I mean, that shows you how strong they are. You know, you'll see them growing in swamps. You'll see them growing as parking lot trees. And so they can tolerate a lot, but they do much better when you take care of them.
So,
I guess one of the final notes on the species is I'm curious, do you two have any kind of questions in terms of the getting to the refinement stages or kind of later stages of development? Does it feel like, are there any big outstanding questions? Actually, I guess for any stage of development, any big outstanding questions that you would love to see answered by the community over time?
Oh, yeah, that's great. I mean, you know, as far as developing them later on for, you know, is pinching growth like you would traditionally do with Japanese maple, would that be beneficial?
It works.
Yeah, it works. I'm wondering, you know, cutting back hard to encourage interior versus pinch tip, you know, growth. You know, I want to see a little bit more of those, you know, versus like cut and grow versus wiring styles as well. I mean, I guess there's a couple of different ways. I mean, but that's going to give you different results, obviously. But I mean, I feel like we just need more. Like we said, there's not a lot of research in how the species grows and develops. I've seen you, Jonas, talk about them, Michael Hagedorn talk about them, obviously, and Arthur Jura talk about them. I said it earlier wrong. But anyway, so if you go over to the curator's
journal.
That's his blog posting site there. And he's posted a good bit about growth habit and, you know.
It's a great resource, good starting point for learning about them.
Yep. A lot of
and you get stories of the trees.
Exactly. Beautiful stories.
Arthur did a good job of that.
Yep. But yeah, I think developmental questions for the community is just, what are your struggles and are like the leaf spots is, I think the leaf spot thing is the most common thing I've heard from bonsai practitioners in Louisiana. They just can't get over that. So is that big of a deal, you know? But you know, I think there just needs to be more research from just the generalized community of people who are doing bonsai here. Because you kind of like how I joke about like everyone's got a bald cypress here. Why doesn't everybody also have an Acer rubrum as well? We just need to kind of build that up.
And there might be reasons for that, and time will tell. For the leaf spot, don't keep the roots so wet, don't overhead water, and then see if those two things help. Bad soil is going to lead to more, and overhead watering is definitely going to lead to more. If your soil and watering is perfect and you're still getting it, then you're down to more preventative treatments, and then you get to decide if you want to do that.
Yeah.
But I think you're exactly right. That's more of an environmental concern.
Yep.
because
yeah,
you know, the way that I've been growing my red maples, I haven't seen leaf spot in a while. I mean, it hasn't been something I've had to deal with, even if it's humid here, you know. But yeah. So anything in regards to that, Carmen, or are you ready to wrap up?
No, I'm just excited to see more people using them and developing them, because I think it is an underutilized species that's very readily available. So hopefully in the next, you know, 10, 15 years, we'll see more and more trees, more of the red maples, you know, coming out of hiding and into circulation. So I'm just excited to see more good trees.
Yeah. Always want to see more good bones.
My question is about how much branch density we can get on them, because they appear to not support the same level of branch density as other maples, which will just always give them a unique kind of look and feel. I think it's more than adequate for bonsai, but related to that open question is, are there any sizes to which they're best suited? It might be that they don't make as much sense on very small scales. Maybe someone will prove that wrong and will make fantastic little shohina out of them. But when things don't get as dense, or they're more prone to, you know, not give you that first internode or two that you want, it can be challenging to create scale effectively at different sizes. And so we know that kind of the Khifu size works. We know that a little bit bigger than that works, but I'll be curious if like the big loose forest that I have, it's a perfect candidate for that. And so I'm just kind of curious, you know, if we push them more and pinch, pluck, cut more, are we going to be able to get more density, or is it that just kind of one of the inherent challenges of the species that we can only go so far with them? Time will answer that in time, but good technique repeated over time is going to answer that question.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a great question.
I think that, I've attempted a few smaller trees, but yes, I would like, if anyone has a shohin Acer rubrum, please send it over to us, you know, either through social media, through the Instagram for little things, or you can hit me up on email at evan@underhillbonsai.com. But yeah, I think overall, just kind of wrapping up the whole thing, it's into a neat little package, is saying, please grow more Acer rubrum. Go pull a sapling that you see growing, you know, in a gutter or out of a nurse log somewhere in your yard. If you see that happening, just pull it out and put it in a container and grow it out. And you won't be sorry if you go in and actually work the roots at an early age and start growing them out. They make beautiful starter trees, and there's plenty of inspiration in the woods to see. If you want to see older Acer rubrums, they're, like we said, they're one of the most common trees in North America, so it's going to be easy to spot them, obviously on the East Coast. But yeah, I hope that we get a lot more listeners, get inspired, and you know, I know we have our Discord too, so if you're a bonsai bud, just drop your Acer rubrum in the Discord as well. But yeah, let's go ahead and wrap us up. So thanks for hanging out, Jonas. We're going to go ahead and do our shout-outs real quick. So I know we've done this a few times with you already, but for listeners that just stepped into this episode, tell people where to see your work and your stuff online.
BonsaiTonight.com is the website, and I'm Bonsai Tonight as well on whether it's Facebook or Instagram. Little Book of Bonsai is the go-to beginner book for people getting started in bonsai, and the Pacific Bonsai Expo is the event that I host along with Andrew Robson and Eric Schrader, and that's held every 2 years. We're going to be doing it again in 2 years. And beyond that, the only other thing I wanted to mention, which I've been very excited about lately, is I've got a new book coming out next year. And I just received my first advance copy a couple days ago. And so
awesome.
In April, there'll be a new book called The Essential Bonsai Book coming out. And I am very excited about that. It has far more detail that is kind of squarely aimed at pretty much everyone in every club. It's just a lot of practical advice for helping people to really create collections that are going to make bonsai more fun for them.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Oh, I'm so excited for that book.
Yes. Thank you so much for writing the first book and the follow-up. Like you said, we mentioned this in the past, that when you do release that book, we're going to have you on again to talk about your book again. Just be ready for that. And we can promote the crap out of that, because that book, little book of bonsai, we sell it here at the nursery.
I don't know if you can see on my camera. It's on the bookshelf.
Yeah, I can. I noticed that. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, we have several of them, and we sell a lot of that book. So yes. Like Jonas said, go to Bonesight Tonight on social medias.com as well. Check out all of his articles. Really, really great stuff there. And yeah, we do appreciate every time that you come onto the show and just give us all this really great insight. People have also made note of how smooth your voice is. People have joked about that. They like hearing that as well. So it's just something that was mentioned
in the episode. Radio voice any old time.
Yes.
But yeah, really appreciate you hanging out with us, Jonas. And for, like I said, other shout outs, if you want to read some more material from me, from Evan at Underhill, you can go to underhillbonesai.com. I have articles that I've written as well, not nearly as many as Jonas, but you can go over there and check out some stuff that I've written. I will be doing a follow-up article about Acerubrum that will kind of tie into this episode as well, that will be there, about some of the things that I've done with Acerubrum. And then you can, of course, look at social media, Underhill Bonesai store for stuff that we're selling. Christmas has been very aggressive this year. We've made a lot of good online sales. So if you've purchased a tree from Underhill, thank you so much this past holiday season. But yeah, we do have stuff available there as purchase as well. And then like Jonas said about the show that he does, I might as well just kind of put that in here. We do Say Bonesai in March. It's going to be March 27th to the 30th. We're going to be doing a full weekend of Bonesai fun with live jazz music and boiled crawfish. It's going to be a great time. And then Carmen, where do they go and check out your stuff at?
You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Becoming Bonesai. And let's see, this one comes out in the new year, right? So I'm going to hope that my website's up.
We will see.
But when that launches, I will share the URL with everybody just to be sure that, you know, it gets out there. And be sure to check out the Purple Plant Society, the National Women's Bonsai Group, working to inspire women to get more involved in bonsai. Yeah.
Yep. And I am a member of the Purple Plant Society, so you don't have to be a woman to support. Please support your women in bonsai. Thank you so much for hanging out, Jonas. And thank you to our listeners and our bonsai buds for hanging out this week and learning about Acerubrum. So, you want to say goodbye?
Hi.
Goodbye, everybody. Y'all have a great week.